loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
All right, Friday morning, it's time for our political panel here at RCR, one of the highlights of the week for me because it's, well, it's informative, it's fun, and we get to meet interesting people like Annie O'Brien. Annie, welcome. First visit to our panel. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's exciting.
You sound excited.
Yeah.
When you're really excited, how do you sound?
I don't know. I was probably really excited when we got rid of this government.
Okay, so yeah.
That was exciting. And I'm not sure how long that will last, though, because I tend to get sick of governments very quickly.
Okay, easily bored. It's like me.
Yeah.
All right, Alfred Ngaro. Last time Alfred we met was a chat on RCR last year. That was really interesting. Thanks for coming back to RCR, but being on the panel for the first time, nice to have you. Welcome.
Yeah, look, it's great to be here. I was just saying that, look, Annie and I are so trendy, unlike you and Cam. And
what do you mean the RCR shirt's pretty cool?
No. We're colour coordinated.
He's loyal.
Right? Yeah. We're colour coordinated, eh, Annie? That's what
we have. Text me before we came on air.
Yeah.
And of course, Alfred is. You're still the leader of New Zealand.
Yeah, I am. I'm still the leader of New Zealand, but obviously we're kind of a little bit quiet. Had a bit of a the last 4 months has been a bit tough for us as a whānau, as a family. So lost my mum, lost my brother,
I heard that.
Lost my brother-in-law.
Sympathies to you, Alfred.
Yeah,
Alfred,
so you know, that's part of life.
Mm. It is. Mm. Great to have you, and needs no introduction, really, right?
No. Good morning, everybody.
Bringing up the tail end.
Yeah, oh well, somebody
Cam
has
Slater
to.
From The Crunch is back, of course, RCR host. So nice to have you folks here. Let's just get straight into it. We've got a whole lot of issues to get around. Kāinga Ora should be a scandal, Cam.
But it should be. I mean, I'm surprised that we haven't seen more squawking, Annie, from the Taxpayers Union about what's been revealed by Bill English's inquiry into what's been going on at Kāinga Ora. And just some bullet points here. Their annual operating expenditure has grown from $1.5 billion in 2019 to 2020 to $2.5 billion in 2022 and 23. But on top of that, their deficits have forecast to grow from a massive $520 million to $700 million. And then on top of that, if that wasn't bad enough, they've got this massive debt there, which is currently sitting at $12.8 billion, but predicted to grow by 2028 to $23 billion. It goes on and on and on. And you have to wonder why on earth we take anything that the Labour Party says seriously when we seem to see every week or every month more of these scandals coming out of profligate waste, no achievements being done, no board that's actually managing these things properly. They've got all of their lickspittles and you know, mates on the board. The chair was Mark Goshie, a former a minister and a Labour MP and a union boss, and they've all scuttled off. No consequences. If this was a private organisation, a private company, all of those directors would probably now be on charges.
Well, they'd be fallen over.
Well,
it'd be an epic disaster, wouldn't it?
It's trading while insolvent. But because it's
illegal,
a government, it is illegal. But whilst it's a government organisation, you really can't get in trouble for trading while insolvent. But this is an unmitigated disaster. This organisation is set up to provide housing for the least among us, and yet they've managed it so poorly over the last 6 years that it's now in a massive hole. And Simon Moota, who's been appointed as the new chair, has got a real job on his hands.
All right, what do we think?
Yeah, look, I just want to, I'll climb in there and and say that I agree with Cam. Look, it all starts off with political ideology. We've got to go back to, you know, the back of a napkin idea about Kiwi Build, where old sort of Phil Twyford came out and said, we can do this. But don't forget, these manifestos are made up when they see the demand publicly, when people are saying, hey, we don't have enough. And so what happens is that this political ideology, this thinking that we can solve it, and they throw out this quick fix. People bought into it. You know, I was there with the National Party. I was a minister. I had an associate portfolio around Kāinga at that time, around Housing Corporation. And, you know, with Amy Adams, we were already looking at not only what the numbers that we were building, but things like, for instance, transitioning people into home ownership and elements like that. And so what happened is that because the demand grew, right, this is what was going on. Look, I want to say that when we talk about demand, because I agree with the facts, but we need to go back to what drives this, right? What's the drivers to get to where we are? Number one, it's a failure because of an ideology. Number two, it's people who don't understand the system and how do you shift it. Michael Bassett wrote a report that was initiated by the New Zealand Institute, and in that report, he talked about housing affordability. And inside that, there are three things that were pressurizing the system. Number one is regulations, which we know it's all the consenting process. Number two is that around our main city centres, land became what you call unaffordable because we had these arbitrary lines that had our metropolitan urban limits. So in other words, land banking started happening. So that was the third one. But here's the third one that no one wants to talk about. And I say this because I think it's important, but in his report, what happened, the breakdown of the family unit meant that overnight demand continued to double. And what he showed is that the breakdown in the family unit had basically increased since the 1970s, almost doubled, almost tripled. But what Michael said, no one wants to talk about that. Now, I'm only mentioning it because the factors to change is not just about building more houses. How do you actually have places that, you know, families will thrive, that it's a community? We're not using town planning principles, that you don't just build a whole lot of houses. Glen Innes and Pembia, which Cam and I know really well, under Joseph Sash, became the oldest planned community in New Zealand. And so what happened? They just built these houses. They didn't
They built tens of thousands of houses, Alfred.
Yeah, like, but you got to build houses with community in mind. In other words, how do you get accessibility to opportunities for work? How do you make sure that there's places for kids to play, good education can thrive, law and order, making sure communities are safe, people feel safe in their own communities? So all I want to say, there are some other issues I think that are really important. And I've read the report that Bill English put it through. I think it's a good start. I think there's a few more things to go along the way to solve some of these issues.
Annie.
Well, look, in the interest of total transparency, housing is not an area that I'm usually particularly across, possibly why I still don't own one. But it doesn't take an expert to recognise that Kāinga Ora is a big old mess. I'll leave others to you know, comment on the extraordinary debt and the reckless financial decisions made by the previous government. But what I will say is that, you know, aside from the massive property portfolio, 185,000 New Zealanders rely on Kāinga Ora for social housing. I'm told that's about 72,000 homes across the country. And if KO isn't financially viable, if it all goes up in flames, you know, and large numbers of properties have to be sold up, this has massive knock-on effects on those relying on this social housing for a roof over their heads. And beyond that, if the government has to then find a way to prop up that system, it means cuts and sacrifices everywhere else. So it's not just about, they've racked up some debt and, you know, this particular agency is in trouble. It puts everything in trouble when something is mismanaged to this degree.
Yeah, 100% there. But you look at it, the reason why this thing is unsustainable and unstable is the rent arrears. So in the last year of the national government in 2017, the rent arrears in Kāinga Ora was $1 million. So across those 180,000 houses or people, there was about $1 million outstanding. 6 years later, it's $21 million in rent arrears. And remember, that people who are in Kāinga-ora in this housing are only paying about 25% of their income in rent. It's capped.
So what does that tell us then?
Well, it tells us that after 6 years of a Labor government, no one is any better off. In fact, when you look at the numbers, we're demonstrably worse off. The waiting lists for state housing have grown and grown and grown. I think it's over 35,000 people waiting for a state house, and there's nothing available. Yet you look at some places, like last night, one of my buddies mentioned Ōrākei, where there's single dwellings on $2 million sections in Ōrākei. If you sold those sections and redeployed that into somewhere else in Auckland, you could probably get, sell 100 of those houses. That's $200 million at the very least just in the land price that you could then put into developing 10,000 new houses. But they don't do it. Yeah. The measuring stick that the Labor Party people always use is they just look at the amount of money that they've spent. They don't actually look at the outcomes. And so what we've seen is it's growing.
Alfred, okay, for whoever's across this, you've been across it before, previous job. Who lets this get out of control like this?
Well, it's you have to go back that people who take on a leadership role and don't understand how systems work, because you've got to be able to understand the system. So my background is in electrics and electrical and so forth, and so we deal with schematics. And so you have to read the system to understand how it operates, and if you want to improve it, how do you fix it? So, for instance, one of the things that we were finding around, so I had the portfolio around homelessness and emergency transitional housing, and everyone just looks at the key number, but no one goes down to find out what are the key issues that are here. So let's take, for instance, where we're finding a big demand was that when we deinstitutionalized our mental health facilities, what happened is that we just basically threw them out in the community, and the health Ministry of Health started working with them, but then all of a sudden they started transitioning into Housing Corporation and became their responsibility. So when I took this over, I started getting the Minister of Health to come in, and I said, you need to pick this up and start taking responsibility around that. And so this is where the third sector, which they call the community housing provider sector, was introduced by the national government as a way of saying, we need more than just government to solve the answer around here. Mm-hmm. The great thing about community housing providers, they're people like Salvation Army, Habitat for Humanity, there are mental health sort of providers who said, look, if you give us the ability to have housing, we can not only have the housing for our clients, but then we wrap the support around them. So it's that sort of approach that I believe started to solve this issue around that, and also obviously unlocking things like, for instance, regulation. Remember, leaky homes made us really risk adverse. So you had council saying, no way, mate, we're going to make it harder. All of a sudden, you're 12 months to get a building consent because everyone was afraid. So how do you mitigate the risk, open up the opportunity to be able to, start to build a bit more? But the last thing I'd say then, Paul, but you have to have the ability to think about building communities, right?
Yeah.
And that's got a long-term plan.
And speaking to what you said just before, Annie, the collateral damage that can come from this. I mean, I've spoken twice to the folks in Rotorua. That whole Fenton Street of motels is lined with people have come in out of town, emergency housing, and is causing problems, let me say. So that's what you get.
Alf mentioned the Salvation Army. I'm not sure. They do a lot of good things, and they have been involved in housing. But we've got to take note that on the board of Kāinga-ora, which failed demonstrably, leaving this massive problem that the new government has to fix, was Major Campbell Roberts.
Yep.
Right, from the Salvation Army. So you have to say, well, he sat on the board as the financial status of Kāinga-ora was going south at 100 miles an hour. Right. Yep. As a director, he should have been signalling this loudly and longly to the ministers. And then the ministers would have had to have gone and addressed some of the issues with Grant Robertson. But it's almost like Phil Twyford, who was a minister for four of those years, and Megan Woods, who was a minister for two of those of the 6 years in housing, did nothing. You know, they're sitting there with this organization that's got a board with all sorts of wombles on it, and they're sitting there supposed to be governing Kaiangora. But what they were doing was digging a massive hole, which we all as taxpayers now have to fill.
Dishonorable discharge.
Well, they shouldn't. They should be struck off the list of any government jobs or any directorships ever again. All of them, every single one of them, from the chair, former chair, Mark Goshie, all the way down, including, sadly, people like Major Campbell Roberts.
Okay.
Yeah, and what they did, they stacked them up with people who only had the skill set in one particular area, which is about the social side of things, right? You needed to have people who've got, you know, real good expertise around development, around some of the consenting side, as well as those that engage. Yeah, tendency, you know. So
they became New Zealand's worst landlord. Kaiangora is New Zealand's worst landlord. We see news articles every week about how everyone had complained about a particular tenant, and it was all their fault and not the particular tenant that was causing violence or smashing things up or having parties, whatever.
Tricky situation, though, isn't it, if you've got people who are like Alf described, yeah, with troubled lives.
Look, it's awful. It truly is awful. Mm. But throwing money at it, and that's what they've done. They've thrown billions of dollars at this.
Yep.
And got nothing. That's not the answer. And we've got to look at what Alfred was saying and start looking at some core issues around this, because throwing money at it or digging a bigger hole isn't going to solve any problems.
All right. I want to flick ahead to something you want to talk about, Annie, and that is crime in central Auckland.
Yeah. There was an article in the papers today about it, but I don't think we necessarily need an article to tell us if you're like me and spend a lot of time in central Auckland. I work in the city, and it is a different place than it used to be. I used to live in the city when I was much younger, and I used to walk through town by myself at night to get from my apartment to the gym, and I never worried. Now I am worried just getting, you know, from work, just a few hundred metres. So I think it's an issue that everyone's aware of, but business owners in particular in Auckland Central feel like they're not being heard. Yeah. They feel like, you know, I think one of the key stories that they were talking about today was there's this guy who basically tried to perform a citizen's arrest because he wasn't getting any help with.
Yeah. You're allowed to do that, aren't you?
He was told
until the police turn up and then they arrest you.
Yeah, so he's tried to protect his business because he's been trying to get engagement on, you know, protecting himself through proper channels, and then finally he's gone, well, you know, bugger this, and has tried to grab the shoplifter, and he's got in trouble for it, which...
Well, we know a tap on the shoulder can be assault now. We know that.
We do know that.
You can bash grannies. You can bash grannies. You can punch them in the face. Right? That's okay. But dear, touch a busybody at the airport, now that's assault. Naughty, naughty.
Oh, I know. It's outrageous.
But, Annie, what you're saying, you know, is I avoid central Auckland like I avoid cancer, right? It is a dreadful, barren wasteland that's full of empty shops. You've even got government departments now that are you know, up near the old headquarters of the Auckland City Council. They're all now sending their staff home because they don't want to go out to get their sushi or whatever it is for lunch because of the detritus that's living in the central city.
Absolutely. And I think it's not made any better by the fact that the key advocate for central Auckland is a prison abolitionist who sides with perpetrators, Chloe Swarbrick. you know, it's one thing to have, you know, we need buy-in from the police minister and from Auckland Police and all that kind of thing. But ultimately, for these business owners and for people who work and live in the city, you should be able to go to your MP and say, this is the issue we want advocated. We want, you know, you to go back to Parliament and talk to the people who were in charge of these matters. We want you to talk to, you know, local council, blah, 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 and advocate for us on the issue of crime in our city. She's not going to do it because she thinks that the ideal is to empty the prisons, shut them down, and just let it be a free-for-all.
What does she think will happen?
But on top of that, though, Annie, she was stating on, I think it was on Monday, she was saying after all these crime stories came out, oh, well, I speak to the police every day.
Well,
somebody, see, she's a bald-faced liar because somebody did an Official Information Act request and she's spoken to the police precisely twice since becoming an MP.
And once, one of those times
and
was,
one was
a meet and greet. Yeah.
Right? That's all it was. Mm-hmm. So she out there, you know, in between chanting genocidal slogans, is in advocating for prisons to be abolished. She's just bald-faced lying about what's her responsibility. She's the local MP.
I like looking at old photos, and I've seen quite a few of, you know, Auckland 70s Queen Street. And
it was full of people.
Oh, it's a different, it's another planet, mate.
Yeah, so I can go one step better.
Our city has a lot of potential as well. It is actually, yeah. You know, we're, you know, bars and restaurants on the waterways. We've got really cool development with Commercial Bay and Britomart. There's so much potential, and yet instead of harnessing that, they decided to make Queen Street, you know, car unfriendly, and so made it a wasteland, which was the main arterial route through.
Yeah.
I can go one step better than all of you guys because my mother gave birth to me in Auckland City. So,
sorry, you're going to have to qualify that. You mean in city?
Actually, in the city, exactly. So I was born in St. Helens Hospital.
All right.
And when St. Helens Hospital was in Pitt Street, right across from the YMCA. And then I grew up in Ponsonby back in the day when, you know, there was the migration of Pacifica in there. So Aspen Ponce was a bit of a Polynesian hub in John Street. So I know the city really well. I used to go there as a kid, and, you know, you had the St. James Theatre, the Odeon Theatre. They had a thing called Luna Park, Cam, which was where all the pinball machines back in our day.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, when Paul will know, you guys, I mean, Annie won't even ever heard that. Her grandfather probably talked about it. But anyway, so the thing is, you're absolutely right, because it was a place in which you became so familiar. But here's the thing, is that even as young kids, we felt safe.
Mm.
Like, we could walk all the way from John Street, all the way up the hill, down up Vermont Street, then go across Ponsonby Road, and then you go down College Hill, and then you'd walk into town. And that's what you did as kids. You know, it was a place to thrive. I think there's two things that challenge us, is that, you know, the CBD was the port, and, you know, the ports were central parts of a city, right? And that's where your main form of transportation.
Yeah.
We've now got the airport. And as you know, the thing about, they're now creating these things called airport cities. So we've got a metropolis. And so I find it really strange that we keep trying to drive people back to the CBD when the truth is,
we don't want to be there.
We don't want to be there. I mean, it's harder to be there. And you talk about safety. I mean, you're like, I'll tell this little story. When Paul Goldsmith, he was a city councillor. Do you remember this, Cam?
Yeah, I do.
And then Banksy gave him the job, right? I was on the Safest City Executive with Senior Inspector John Palmer and Brett Eklund. And so we were there. And old Goldie comes into the meeting, first time I'd met Goldie, and he said, what are we going to do with all of this? The city is looking unsafe. Da, 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 da. Anyway, someone made a statement, I think it was him, he said, oh, well, maybe we'll just get a big hose and hose them all down, clean the city, the central city up. Anyway, so somehow the media get a hold of this, so old Goldie comes out, and he said, oh, we heard that you've got a strategy to, you know, to clean the city. Oh, yeah, a big fire hose, and clean out all the riffraff and all the rest of it. So it was a bit of a fun thing. Anyway, they go to John Banks, right, as the mayor. And he's the consummate politician because he pauses and he says this. And he said, well, I was a waif one time in my life. And I can remember the day where I know what it feels like to press my nose against the glass. So what does that mean, Annie? Goldie got thrown under the bus, right?
But the thing with the crime, it's not just in the central city. It's all over Auckland. You know, you go onto TikTok and you can see videos of people walking out of supermarkets with whole trolley full, you know. And, you get a little one of those little bags from the supermarket. It's got $100 worth of stuff in it. Imagine how much is in a trolley, right?
Yeah. So, $400, $500, $600.
And the rest, minimum. Right? $600, $700. They just walk out. I was talking to the person on the counter down at Woolworths earlier today when I was doing a bit of shopping, and somebody had walked out and she was having to unscan everything and do all that. And I said, how often does this happen? She says, 4 or 5 times a day. Wow. And that's in Takapuna.
Yeah.
Right? And there is no consequences for these people. They're walking around just robbing us blind, and we're paying for that in increased grocery prices because they don't want to lose money. So, you know, they're factoring in whatever percentage for shoplifting. It's absolutely out of control. Almost every day in Auckland, there's some sort of violent robbery somewhere. You know, last night I had the police helicopter hovering over my place in Takapuna for about 45 minutes.
What have you been doing?
Well, I was cleaning my guns.
Well, in the backyard, sort of obvious to everyone.
Yeah, but you know, you go back to the 70s or even the 80s. I can remember going, you know, I would go into work. I worked at the National Bank in Jean Bannon Place in those days.
Behind the counter, Cam, was it?
Yeah, various different jobs. I think I did every job in the place. And if I'd been hunting on the weekend and something wasn't right with my rifle, I'd take it into work, you know, I'd leave it with the security guard at the bank. And then at lunchtime, I'd grab my rifle and I'd stroll up to Tisdall's gun shop halfway up Queen Street and drop it off. And nobody said anything. Nobody did anything, you know. And these days, if you even have a bag with a gun in it, you've got all of these people having kittens, you know, about it.
So. Okay, well, I'm not surprised. I heard airports described nowadays as a shopping center with a runway. So there you go, how things have
An
changed.
An expensive shopping center with a runway.
Oh, yeah, and they never stop spending either.
Charged like wounded bulls.
Somebody mentioned Chloe Schwabrick. I think it was you, Cam, but I think Alf wants to comment on this, the Q&A interview and the discussion of MPs behaving badly. What have you got to say about that, Alf?
Yeah, I sort of think that Jack Tang went a little soft. You know, I think he could have pushed it a lot more. You know, Chloe is, you know, she's trying to be older than what she is, right? And
how old is she again? She's in her 20s, is she?
No idea. You know,
she's 29.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she's getting on a bit.
She's a spring lamb trying to sound like a bit of mutton, you know, but it doesn't work. You know, it's not coming across that way because she keeps avoiding the real question, the real answer, which is, holding her MPs to account. She's very big on holding everyone else to account, but when it comes to her, you know, she keeps deferring, oh, you know, we can't do this because it's before the review and so forth. I mean, when you think about what's happened in both cases with Julianne Genta and Darlene Tana, you know, there were examples there that were given when Jack sort of talked about what had happened with when Chris Luxon then held.
You missed a name off that list, Alf. You missed a name.
Who's that? Who's
the one, the clothing store?
That's right.
It's a very long list, though.
Gold Riz Garaman.
Julianne Genta and her anger problems. And
fashion
then,
icon.
And now you've got El Woko Loco swearing in Parliament.
Who's that?
Ricardo.
El Woko Loco.
F-bomb in there.
Yeah.
I mean, even bloody Phil Twyford called himself righteous.
Didn't Phil Twyford just look righteous? You know, if he'd had a dog collar on, he could have been an Anglican priest. But you know, the thing is that the Greens, they're so sanctimonious. They lecture us about how better they are than everybody else. And then actually when you scratch the surface, particularly Darlene Tana, I mean, not only is she accused of exploiting immigrant labour, but now it appears that she's got some sort of dodgy shenanigans going on with an article in a Verve magazine that was, you know, promoting her without a promoter statement, because we've now discovered That was a paid for article.
Another one.
So a paid for article that the magazine says that the bill was paid for by Darlene Towner's husband. The Green Party has said, no, we paid the bill. So there's all this green, oozy, murky sort of carry on going on. It just keeps on keeping on. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what really gets me is when they throw out the race card, right? So, you know, when Tory Farnow was doing that, she's a, you know, Green Party member, they throw out, woman of colour, you know, they have this pressure. And then woman of politics, they have this issue. When Goldrez was going through, you know, it just
we never get a look in.
You know, white's a colour too, eh?
And also, I will say, though, people will say that. Judith Collins, when she gets abused, right?
Yeah. Most people, it's appalling abuse she gets.
Yeah, so I worked for her for a year when she was leader, and I had access to her socials and all that. I saw the stuff that she was sent. She got sent images of firing squads and that kind of thing. It was constant abuse. And yet, because she's not the right kind of woman, she's a conservative, you know, on the centre right woman. She doesn't get the same, you know, tears that say Jacinda got. So it's all contingent on your politics.
Yeah. And I know Cam said that white's a colour, but you know, you're going to have to break that down. Is it translucent? Is it opaque? You know, come on, Cam. Got to get a bit more busier than that, buddy.
I mean, it doesn't.
Yeah,
really
if I sit in the sun, I just turn pink.
It doesn't apply to me because I get called racist all the time. You're a racist, and usually the people who say you're a racist spell you're incorrectly, and so yeah, it kind of doesn't mean anything when they can't even get their grammar correct. But I always just reply to them, "I'm Fijian. What do you mean?"
Well, that's a good comeback. Rank hypocrisy of Kerry Allen.
She just winds me up. There's another one of these person of colour, woman on the left, Wahine Maori, you know, all of the excuses. Actually, she's just a shabby little drunk that can't handle the pressure. But yeah, she made this speech, you know, when she was the Justice Minister about how it was awful that we had all these criminals that were making late guilty pleas and it just holds up the court system. Big speech that she made to the Criminal Bar Association, and then, oh dear, what happens with her when she's up on charges? She waits till the morning of her court hearing after she's told the media that she's going to defend this. There's a part of the law that's unclear. What does she do? Pleads guilty, gets a slap on the wrist with a very, very well-soaked bus ticket. You know, soaked so much that it was almost disintegrating. The judge sort of lightly applied it to her wrist, and she gets off pretty much scot-free. $300 fine and a couple of grand for some
$5,200 and something for the damage, I guess. Annie, it sounded like you didn't like that label that Cam had there.
Oh no, I'm
Cabby, a little drunk.
Oh no, I think she clearly does have some issues there, and I think she's probably acknowledged that. And also it's come in some of the stories through this guilty plea. I think it was mentioned she had a previous drink driving charge. So it's clearly an issue that she's had some trouble. I try to put myself in her shoes to try and guess what she was doing with not pleading guilty straight away. And the only thing I can really come up with is that, you know, she was all over the place. She wasn't thinking clearly. Sounds like she wasn't listening to advice, and now she seems to be in a bit of a better place mentally, and I think maybe that might be behind it, if I'm being charitable. She certainly seems happier and healthier online and appears to be involved in the campaign of Rhea Hall for the mayor of Tauranga. So that was a really white girl way of saying Tauranga.
Close.
it was always Tauranga when I was brought up.
But interestingly, I found it so cringy, and I felt bad laughing at it, and then I thought, oh, nah, I'm just going to laugh at it. Anyway, she seems to be pursuing a career as an influencer. So on her Instagram, I gave her 3 minutes of my life and watched her wash her face and put $150 moisturizer on. And I don't know who her audience is, because I sure as heck cannot afford $150 moisturizer. But yeah, she was doing the whole influencer routine. So, you know, justice minister to Instagram influencer, what a path of, what a trajectory.
There must have been something though in the way she sort of did her thing that must have called into question her appropriateness for that role at some point. Who would...
What, justice minister or influencer?
Well, I was thinking justice minister, because clearly there must have been issues through there. There's probably more to that, but no, now the only, influencer.
The only qualification she had for that role was she has, was a lesbian Maori. Because that's...
She was a lawyer. Yeah,
sure, but, you know, the point I'm making here is that Jacinda Ardern didn't pick people for their... for what they could do in a position. She picked people to placate a particular sector of the Labour caucus. Right? And that's how you ended up with fools like, you know, Phil Twyford and Megan Woods running housing. You know, that's why you had Kerry Allen doing justice minister. That's why you had...
David Clark.
Well, David Clark should have been the Minister for Cycling.
The River of Filth.
Theologian.
No, it's Michael Wood.
It's Michael Wood.
Sorry.
And then you look at who the... Nanaia Mahuta, the most unqualified person ever to be a foreign minister.
Can you imagine her up against Lavrov or the Chinese foreign minister?
She must have been afraid of flying, because she almost never went overseas. Then it's kind of the role of the foreign minister.
She genuinely didn't like it.
Well, given her immense size when she started, I can understand why.
What would you say,
why.
Though, hey, thanks for the offer, but I'm shit scared of flying and I don't like travelling, and maybe that could be a bit of a problem if you want me to be the foreign minister, just say.
Well, you look at Winston, he's been jet-setting all over the place, and with respect to him, he's
a great job.
Years. And he's all over traveling and meeting all the people. And I mean, yes, Nanaia had COVID to contend with. But I found that particular appointment strange, because it seemed like she didn't like it. Whereas at least for the local government, she'd been preparing for 25 years to slap those laws down and do the Three Waters. And, so it was strange.
Yeah. I remember that when I was... still in Parliament, one of the things I did was actually I did a little bit of a research on all the Labour MPs, and I can tell you it was quite amazing. So the majority of them were teachers, unionists. In fact, the only one, and a couple of lawyers thrown in there, the only one that had any sort of commercial experience was David Parker, and even then it was only as an associate, right, for a law firm. But other than that, then the fish and chippy girl that became the Prime Minister of the country, there wasn't a lot that was in it. So the cupboard was really bare, right? And so they were giving first-timers. And like I said, when you ask the question, Paul, how do you shift the system? You have to have people who've got some experience who understand how a system could work. And instead, what they happened, we got all these people filling roles who just came up with ideas that they think they could quick fix, make something sound really good. So we're... You know, it was full of sound bites, right? All they were just making announcements. And look, I remember that we were coming out of the House of Parliament, and do you remember the whole thing around the ban on oil and gas exploration?
Yeah.
Well, we came out and we were going across the bridge, and we looked at it. Jacinda was down there because there was like four or five protesters out there. She was about to head overseas to Geneva, and she went and made an announcement. And here's how I know it was really bad, because I could hear the advisors talking from the window, saying to them, say, hell, what are we going to do here? Scrambling around to try and think of something they could do. It was all on the hoof. It was just, again, it was populist politics, just trying to sort of make it sound like I'm amazing, right?
You could see Shane Jones over her shoulder when she just made that announcement.
His face was like
what the hell?
He actually covered his face with his hand and bowed his head like, good. It's like, what on earth is this stupid woman doing?
Yeah, but it's not a training ground. You should know something when you get there, because the rest of us take the hits. Repeal of Section 7AA from Oranga Tamariki Act, Annie.
It's been a tense couple of weeks in Parliament with the repeal of Section 7AA from the Ōranga Tamariki Act. It has been a hideous, demonstration of where racial politics are in New Zealand at the moment, at least on the political side of things. Most of us living in the real world just marry each other, get on with things and enjoy our lives as an integrated society. But in Parliament, it's just been an absolute, am I allowed to say shit show? I don't know, but it's
too late.
I've said it. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much your listeners will know about Section 7AA, but it was brought in 2021. It was added to the Act as a section to ensure the adherence to Titiriti or Waitangi and to make sure that, whakapapa was prioritised. It's written really quite vaguely, which is where the argument comes in from the other side, where they say, well, it doesn't say that this has to come before wellbeing. It doesn't say that. But in practice, that's what it's being used to justify. And so that's where the problem is with that section. It's that it's been used to justify removing Māori children from happy, healthy environments where they love the foster parents they have, but they are from a different race. And it's been used to justify removing them and taking them to some distant relative they may not have met, but who has Māori ancestry, and that somehow makes them better for the child. And so Karen Shaw, who is the Minister of Children and who is Māori herself and grew up in and out of the SIF system, she's introduced this bill to remove that section from the Act, so to basically consolidate the idea that a child's well-being, safety comes first before anything else.
As it should be.
Except she's the wrong sort of Maori, and so she's been attacked. And
it's been hideous.
And even on Wednesday, you had Te Pāti Māori commenting on Facebook, and David Seymour's highlighted this on X, and this is what they said. Fun fact, we were not in government for the last 6 years. If Section 7AA was around in Karen Chaw's time, she would have been raised Māori. She would have been raised being connected to her whakapapa and having a knowingness, I mean, that's not even a word, of her Māori tanga. Instead, she was raised Pākehā with a disconnection and disdain for her own people. Karen and her experience is exactly why we need Section AA. I mean, the racism that's inherent in that comment is just
but
appalling.
But who's thinking of the child? I mean, I can imagine these terrible separations where the relationship's built up, the life is improved, and they're being ripped out. And
then the other side of it, Paul, which Karen has highlighted, she's been hearing from caregivers, which is that a Māori child is with, say, a Pākehā foster family where they're happy and healthy, and because of this need to satisfy Section 7AA, they are being forced to visit the family that abused them to get their, quota of living in their whakapapa or whatever it is. And so they're being forced to visit with abusive people where they would usually have an arrangement where they didn't engage with them. And so it's decisions that are not taking into account in the first instance what is best for this child. It is thinking of them as a race and not a human being.
Yeah. Alf?
Yeah, so look, I agree. I've got some good friends who are fighting OT Ōranga Tamariki at the moment. They've got their own children, but they also to whāngai and look after Māori children. They're Pākehā. They love these kids. And I tell you, the grief they have to go to consistently to try and justify the things that they're doing. These are kids that have come out of incredibly abusive, traumatised upbringing. So I totally agree there needs to be a shift. But can I just preface this? Because remember, Ōranga Tamariki came out in our time. It came out of a review of a system that had to change. And I just think that at the moment, what the coalition government need to be very careful of is that you don't swing the pendulum too hard back again. Yeah. And the use of language is important because it gets confused, because what's coming out now is the branding that the Don't Roy, the left, are going to keep using. That number one, they hate Māori. Number two, mm-hmm. we're all one sort of melting pot of people. There's no diversity. There's no differences that are in there. And I think we just need to be careful of how we do that. I agree with the personally, I would see an amendment to it. And I agree with what Annie said, that the first principle is the well-being of the child. Look, I was part of the review. That's what these kids were saying. Number one, we've got kids that were bouncing around 24 different care facilities, you know, in their lifetime of 10, 15 years. So we needed to stop that, have a clear place, care placement that was going to care for them. And you know what the kids overwhelmingly said? We just want to be in a place that we feel that we're loved, that we belong.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to, you know, the families are going to walk us through into our future. So we need to make sure those are the first primary principles. Then you can overlay some of the concerns of the past, where if it fits and it matches with Māori or any other ethnicity, it could be Fijian, you know, whatever it is, if it does and it's appropriate, then absolutely. But if it doesn't, my goodness, go back to first principles. The well-being of the child is important. I just want to say, though, we have to be careful with this coalition government. The Labor Greens, they pushed the pendulum so far the other end that we just can't look like we're just swinging the pendulum back again. Just bring it back to the middle, to the stuff that's common sense that most Kiwis said, yeah, that's right.
Wouldn't you just do it on a case-by-case basis? Is that not common sense? Is that how you, because every individual case is different, has its own thing?
They don't do that, though, Paul, because there is in government and in the public service, this overriding belief in Maori wonderfulness. That's why we'll rename child, youth and family Ōranga Tamariki, and that'll make it all better, right? That's what they do. And then you've got these cases where, that's a Maori child, they'll be better off in a Maori family. Well, would they? You know, that's the thing. It's all of this. Maori were, you know, great conservationists. Oh, yeah, where's the moa? You know, where's a few of the other birds?
I know there's all of that, but it comes down to the child, right? I mean,
exactly, and that's what I'm saying, is that it has to come down to the child. It doesn't matter what the race of that child is. It doesn't matter. It's a child that needs help.
I do think that Alfred makes a really good point, because it is not that culture does not matter, because all of us, whatever culture we're brought up in, it is very important. And that is that can't be lost in this, because I think we can absolutely criticise when it's prioritised above far more important things like survival and safety and well-being. But if those things are covered off, as Alf says, then it is appropriate to think, okay, where will this child thrive? That if you've got the luxury of having that decision making, then culture definitely comes into it, because matching people up is going to work better than potentially having very different
cultures. But it's not the primary concern, eh?
It's not the primary concern. But what has come out of this, which is I think what I kind of want to talk about, is I think for most New Zealanders, we can recognise this. We can all come to this conclusion that safety, well-being first, then culture matters. Cool. What we have seen in Parliament has been hideous, absolutely hideous behaviour. And the way it is being characterised, is it Maria Meno Kapakingi? She has been making these statements saying Māori are being exterminated, the government has an extermination agenda, and this language does nothing but fan the flames of divisive racial tensions. And I can't help but feel very cynical that is what she is trying to do. She's not trying to argue the point of the well-being of Māori children and that she thinks that 7AA needs to retain. She is trying to cause strife.
Well, have a look at the Māori Party, TikTok account, where they've got an ad of a kid, a Māori child, who's saying in English, which is kind of ironic considering one of the claims that this child makes is that we, meaning everybody else, stole his language. And now he's going to stand up and fight And you know, I'm Marion, you can't beat me, and I'm going to stand up and fight for all this. And then there's a list of grievances, talking about stolen land and talking about a whole range of stuff that has got no basis in fact or history or anything else.
It breaks my heart that these children are being taught not only to hate other New Zealanders, but to hate part of their own heritage as well.
It's almost like UNRWA teaching of children, you know, with the Hamas doctrine that all Jews are evil. It's the same sort of stuff that's being taught now to the young people in New Zealand, that white people are bad, colonialism was evil, and the only way we can solve this is to go back to tikanga.
To think you can use children as battle fodder.
Well, they do.
Well, that's what it is, Paul. That's what they're doing. Honestly, you go and watch the first reading. Go watch the first reading of this bill, and it is like...
It's appalling.
Look, we're right up against it. That's a good place to end. I think this has been a fantastic chat. I want to thank Annie O'Brien. How do we describe you now, Annie? What's the handle?
So I work in the private world now.
Oh.
No, I just call myself a women's rights advocate and political commentator.
Cool. We know what you are, Cam.
I'm trouble.
And Alfred Ignardo, thank you so much, Alfred, for coming on. I hope you that was a good experience for you, and I don't think it'll be the last time. So I think that was a great panel. Thanks to everybody for being part of it.
It's great. You're welcome. Thanks, Paul. Awesome.
If you've been told to pull your socks up recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.